Because one of the most important things of a retreat is to try and keep some noble silence. In other words, no need to speak. You spend all your life talking with each other. So on a retreat, we try and keep quiet. So in order to keep quiet, sometimes what noble silence means, it doesn't mean actually shutting up and being like some sort of robot. It means only speaking when it's really important. So in order to find out when it's really important, I want you to practice the three checks. And go through this checklist of three items before you speak. And the first thing to check is, before you speak, just ask yourself, is this really important? And really consider that. And if it is important, then you can tick box number one. And box number two is this really, really important? And if, yeah, it's really, really important, tick down box number two. And I think you've all understood what box number three is. Is this really, really, really important? And if it is really, really, really important, you tick box number three, then you can speak. Usually by that time, the person is gone, so you don't have to speak anyway. But the point is, it stops you just getting into all these useless conversations. So that's what you can do. But the problem is, what do you do when someone speaks to you? Are you supposed to say, you know, you're not supposed to talk? And they say, well, neither are you. You've just broken the rules. And you get. So now what you can do is, if you want to keep the noble silence, and you can't control other people, so what you can do, if you don't want to speak, all you need to do is to put your finger up on the mouth. And that's all you need to do. So you're not saying anything. And they realize that you want to keep quiet, which is your right in this monastery. But if there is a lot of problems, especially in your cottages, because there's six people in the cottage, and some rooms there's two, so there's seven in the cottages, sometimes, you know, there's always one or two people make a lot of noise. So if it really is a problem, you've done this many, many times, please go and see Dania, the caretaker, and we've got some masking tape. And we can put it over the people's mouths. We put a little hole in there for the straw so they can have a drink and have liquids for the rest of this retreat. So that way they can be quiet. Now, this is not trying to control people or give people a hard time. It just actually helps with the meditation practice. Simply because you're not speaking with your mouth, you find you don't tend to speak so much inside, with that mouth between the ears. In other words, you don't think so much. You don't hold all these conversations with yourself. So first of all, we start with external speech, which shouldn't really be that hard. And number two, then we go into the internal part so we can keep quiet inside. And there's so much beautiful things to see around here. What do you want to have conversations for? This is a beautiful morning. The trees are, you know, very green in the sunshine. We've had a very wet winter this year. So all the bush is very lush, very beautiful. Especially the mornings here when the sun comes out, or even the evenings, you can see the sunset down the valley. It's a very beautiful situation in this little retreat center. So every time you're thinking about something, you're not enjoying what's happening there. And the story, which emphasizes this, and as you all know, I like to tell things in stories because they convey the message far more profoundly and also in a way that you will remember. It's a story which I've told so many times, but it is the best with regard to silence. And that was the story of the Taoist master Lao Tzu, who would every evening go on a walk out of his monastery, and he would allow one disciple, only one, to accompany him every time. But the disciple who accompanied the master had to keep quiet. It was a golden rule. They weren't allowed to speak on the walk with the master. They can enjoy the nature in silence. One evening, he went on a walk with a young man, a new disciple, and they came to a ridge of the mountains at sunset. And it's such a beautiful sunset, the young disciple forgot the rule and burst out by saying, "Wow, what a beautiful sunset." He'd broken the rule. At which point the master turned around, went back to the monastery, and then said, "That young man is never allowed to go on a walk with me ever again throughout his whole life." He'd been red carded, as they say these days. And of course, when that happens to a friend of yours, it's a bit tough punishment, just because he said one sentence to be banned for life. So his friends tried to intercede with the master. "Oh, give him a break. It's only one sentence. And anyway, what's wrong with speaking on the walk?" And that is where the master said something which I would never forget. When I read this first time, I thought, wow, that opens up the meaning of silence and why you should be silent. And the master said, "When my disciple said, 'What a beautiful sunset,' he wasn't watching the sunset anymore. He was only watching the words." He wasn't watching the sunset. He was watching the words. I hope you get that point, because it's a very powerful, beautiful point. When you're thinking, you're not experiencing life anymore. You're experiencing the thought world. And it's very different. The word, "What a beautiful sunset," and seeing the sunset are two different realities. And one of the reasons why human beings are always getting themselves into trouble, never understanding things, is because they know the world of thought, but they don't know the reality behind it. They never see the sunsets, they just see the words. I was looking last night as we left here. It was a bit cloudy, but at least the full moon was up, a beautiful full moon. And you know, sometimes here in Australia, because we're far enough away from the city, you get these beautiful skies, clear night skies where you see the whole of the stars. But because I was trained in science, you know, I was a member of the Astronomical Society in Cambridge, and I got to know the names of all the stars and the constellations, which one was which, and whether it was, say, a galaxy you were seeing up there, or a star, or exactly what it was. And it took me years to forget all that learning so I could see the stars. Because I could never see the stars when I learned so much about them. All I could see was Alpha Centauri, there's Sirius, the dog star. I could see all these other little things, but I could never see the stars. It's only when I was in Thailand, it took me many years to forget all of that learning, so I could just see the beauty of the stars, not their names. And I know there are some botanists, and they go walking in the bush here, and they point out all the names of the plants and the trees and everything else in this forest. And they can never see the trees anymore, they just see the names. Here, on this retreat, please forget all the names, and just see the sunset without the name. You see so much more. And it's also far more peaceful. So that's why we keep noble silence. We don't give people names. We don't need to even give the morning a name by saying, "Good morning." You can just smile. A smile, you can't put a name on a smile, it's just a nice gesture. So I know that people before have complained that whenever there's noble silence in a retreat, they feel very uncomfortable, because people take that noble silence, no talking, no smiling, no happiness. And that is not this retreat which we want here. It's all right to smile at one another and to grin, but no need to talk. So when you see your friend in the morning, you don't need to say good morning, just smile at them. And that's a very beautiful gesture. That's a gesture of friendship. What words are really supposed to convey is just a friendship. We're working here together. And a smile can do that far more powerfully than any words. So we keep it quiet. And because we keep it silent, we actually start to see more things. Instead of the words, we start to see the things. We start to see the stars without knowing which one is which. We start to see the sunset. We start to see all the flowers and the trees and the birds in the forest. We don't need to know their names. We can just enjoy what they are, listen to their songs. Enjoy the feeling of the warmth of the sun on your skin in the early morning. When it rains, just go out and get wet. It's not going to kill you. In fact, it's just so beautiful. You know, sometimes you see little kids. Little kids, they don't know that it's wrong to get wet in the rain. So they go and play, they get totally soaked, and they enjoy themselves 100%. But we know if I get wet, I've got to dry my clothes, I get a cold, it's wrong, I look a mess. Oh, come on. See if you can just enjoy the beautiful nature here. It's one of the reasons why we hold retreats in a place like this. It's peaceful, it's natural, it's conducive. You've got a nice little place you can rest at night time or rest during the day. And the rest of the time you can go and chill out with nature. Chill out is a very nice word because it's almost a Buddhist word. The Buddha actually said a person who's enlightened is Siddhi Bhutto, gone to coolness. The ultimate cool dude, the enlightened person, Siddhi Bhutto. So really, so what you really are, you are chilling out, becoming nice and cool, you know, in the proper way of the word. Not freezing to death, but just having this beautiful mind which is cool, which can enjoy things. So if you have trouble with a restless mind, and of course that's what happens in the first few days of a retreat, it takes a while just to be able to, you know, look at a person without having to say anything, without, you know, assuming you have to have a conversation with someone. And that's to not do that is socially unacceptable, at least to say hello, how are you? You don't have to do that here. When you get comfortable with that, then you might also get more comfortable with the internal silence as well. Just as you realize you don't have to talk to each other, you know, to have a very socially cohesive, happy, harmonious group. In the same way, you don't have to talk to yourself. Have a nice, cohesive, harmonious mind. So after a while, you just stop all this inner chatter. And when you stop the inner chatter, it's amazing just how much you can get to know. So in that inner quietness, then you're becoming alive, awake, aware, and very peaceful. So in order to help you, there are all these great techniques which can help you stop all this thinking. One of the great techniques here, because we have the space, is just to go for walks in the bush. And just go and explore. This particular land is 140 acres. They've got a fence all the way around it, so you can't get lost. As long as you don't go through the fence, then you know, we can find you afterwards. But don't go the other side of the fence. So going for a walk in a forest, just exploring, you're going to find some, you know, beautiful spots in the forest, you know, nice views, little rocks, places you can meditate. There's actually a secret meditation garden somewhere, if you can find it. I won't tell you where it is because it's a secret, but you'll find it. And when you find those little places, you can meditate there. It's also very peaceful because you're aware, you're listening to nature, you're feeling. It's even better, if possible, even just to take your shoes off and just feel the ground. But obviously be very careful, you don't sort of cut your feet. But especially you can actually feel the grass or the rocks on your feet. You're becoming aware. Obviously you have to walk very carefully, very slowly, so you don't step on anything which is going to hurt you. But it also means you're becoming more alive, more aware, more mindful, and you become more peaceful. It's amazing just to get to feeling your body again. In life we work so hard, we run around so much, that we're not really in touch with our body. When it rains, we put up an umbrella. When it's cold, we put on a jumper. When it's hot, you know, we sort of, you know, get an aircon on. It's wonderful actually to feel the temperatures in the body. It's not so extreme here that's going to hurt you. And that brings up your mindfulness, become aware again. Especially, you know, here, if you're actually walking inside here, if you can take off your socks, brilliant, because then you can actually feel the floor on your flesh. You can just walk on those red carpets in there. Isn't this just a 5-star retreat? Even for walking meditation, you have red carpets to walk on. That's how much we look after you guys, red carpet treatment. So you can actually feel the sensations on your feet. What that's actually doing is getting you aware of the bodily sensations, the very easy ones to notice, aware of the sounds of the birds or whatever else is happening outside. You're becoming actually aware of the world beyond your thinking. And little by little, that just soaks in. After a while, you don't want to think anymore. What am I wasting all this brain by thinking, thinking, thinking? That's just so much rubbish when there's so much beautiful, peaceful things happening just right outside. What you're doing here is something which is important in meditation. You're valuing things which are more important and taking the value away from things which are of less importance. The only reason why you do think is because you are under the impression that thinking is important. It's going to get you somewhere. You're going to get some reward by carrying on all this thinking, thinking, thinking. You're under the impression if you think enough, you can solve all your problems. How many of you have solved all your problems? And you've been thinking for so many years. And you're smart people. You know, little Sudama was a lawyer. Incredibly smart thinker. He's a US lawyer. What was your field, Sudama? Is it criminal law or environmental law?
Torts, insurance defense.
Insurance. Wow, you really have to be smart. So, you know, she was a super duper thinker. And it's, you know, some of these philosophers which, you know, you meet from time to time when you go give talks in universities, wow, they've read so many books. You go into their studies, and I've actually read those books. You go into my room, most of the books on there I've never read, but they look impressive. These guys are really great thinkers, but are they wise? Where does all that thinking get you? It just goes around in circles after a while. So what we're doing here, we're trying to take the value away from thinking. Unfortunately, it was all your school teachers and professors, they're the ones to blame. Because they told you, come on, think. And I think I remember, or maybe I'm just making this up, but I'm sure it would have happened, that once I was in school, maybe the first year, grade one or its equivalent, and a teacher looked at me and said, what do you think about that? And I said, nothing. Stupid boy, stupid boy. And from that moment on, I lost my ability to meditate. You don't have to think about things. And in fact, you know, you can probably be much wiser. Look, one of the stories, if anybody finds out who this monk was, because I remember hearing about him when I was a young monk, first few years in Thailand, and, you know, it's such a long time ago now, and forgotten, you know, who the monk was. But it was supposed to be this young boy in a village in northeast Thailand. And every person in those days in northeast Thailand had to do 4 years of school. That was all. Even Ajahn Chah only did 4 years. Incredibly intelligent guy. But this fellow, this boy, after 1 year in grade one, his teacher had to fail him. I don't know how you can fail grade one. Maybe, you know, the stick drawings were all over the place. Maybe, you know, he didn't know how to do plasticine work. I don't know. I don't know how you can fail grade one, but he failed. So he had to repeat grade one. All his friends went on to grade two, and he had to stay behind. Second year, he failed again. Now, this guy is in the Guinness Book of Records of being stupid. 2 years, he failed. Grade one, and the third year, they really tried hard to get him, because all his friends were going along, school doing well, but he failed grade two twice. So the third year, they gave extra special attention. And with the best will in the world, they could not pass him. 3 times he failed grade one, so that was out of school. Now that really takes something to fail grade one, 3 years in a row. So, what did they do with him next? Obviously, they thought he was so stupid, waste of time, you know, trying to sort of be a farmer, which is what most of the kids would eventually end up doing. So there's only one thing they would do for someone who was that young and stupid. And I was to ordain as a novice in the local monastery. So in those days, those little temples you used to see in Sri Lanka and Thailand and Burma and all over Southeast Asia, yeah, they were there for, you know, monks, nuns meditating. They're also there as like a social service. You know, kids without homes, orphaned, people who, for one reason or another, ran out of money and they had nowhere else to go. They could always go to the temple. And it was an everything. It was a school, it was an orphanage, it was a hostel, old people's home. You know, it served all those purposes, whatever the community wanted. So anyway, they sent this dummy to the monastery, ordained him as a novice. And the poor guy, you know, he couldn't even remember Namo Tassa. You know, what was that second word again? Namo something or other. He couldn't learn anything. But in those temples, you know, sometimes, as a young monk, I was always taught, oh, you know, those are just village temples. They're not real monks. They don't keep the rules. But there's so many kind people in those monasteries. And I've seen these very kind old abbots. Yeah, they may have a television in their room, but they're incredibly compassionate. They really look after and help other people. So I respect them for that. And so I had one of these very kind abbots who really worked hard with this young kid. But, you know, after 2 or 3 years, even the abbot just gave up. You know, this guy was just, you know, too hard, couldn't learn anything. And, you know, be a monk, you have to remember some things. You have to do some chanting, at least give the 5 precepts. He couldn't do any of that. So the last resort, the place where they send the ones we can send, which they can't even last in a monastery in a village, was send them to the forest monasteries, which is where I come from. But it doesn't mean that all the monks who go to forest monasteries are stupid. But this guy was. And the teacher, instead of teaching him Namo Tassa or how to chant, the teacher just taught him some meditation. Just follow the breath. And this fellow's mind was just so clear and so peaceful. He could do that easily, he could meditate for hours. And in a couple of years, he became fully enlightened. And the story I heard, he could actually do his duties as a monk, you know, by doing the chanting, but in a very strange way. You may believe this or not, but this is what I heard, that he could recall his previous lives, and he recalled a life, you know, not so long ago, where he had been a monk before, where he could learn the chanting, and he actually connected with that previous life, where he did know the chanting, to be able to chant in this life. He sort of channeled the chanting from the previous life, because in this life he couldn't learn anything. His mind was so simple and peaceful. And he became totally enlightened. He didn't have any trouble with thinking. That made him stupid at school, but brilliant as a meditator. So all of you who have really, you know, stuffed up at school, you are great meditators. Come here. All of those of you who got degrees, like me, we're, you know, really, you know, we're behind the eight ball. So the reason is that some of these people, you know, they value the silence much more than the thinking. And because people value the silence more than the thinking, especially on retreats, whatever you value the most, you're inclined towards. What do you have for breakfast this morning? I had so much on offer. What you valued the most is what you chose and what you put in your mouth. So why did you choose that? Because you thought it was tasty, delicious, and good for your health. So look, are thoughts good for your health? Are they tasty or are they torturing? They're certainly not good for your health. You know that because they send you crazy sometimes. So after a while, when we change our value systems, we can look at all that thinking and say, no, not now. It's not going to get me anywhere. I'm just going to drop it, take away its value, and instead value silence. In English, they say that silence is golden. And I checked in the newspapers, people tell me the gold price is increasing every day. So silence is even more valuable than it was last time I taught a retreat. So, why can't we value silence instead of valuing thoughts? So, I will now show you what I mean. This is what I call a meditating teacher's trick, one of the skillful means, which is very, very effective. Because it's not just, you know, giving a talk which helps people meditate. It's almost like holding their hands and, you know, putting their head in the water so they can know how wet it is. And this is the technique of understanding what I mean by silence. So, as I am speaking, some of you have heard this before, but please don't interrupt and spoil it for other people. Because as I am speaking, I'm going to ask you also not just to listen to what I'm saying, but listen to the reaction in your mind. What's happening inside of you as I'm speaking? Because as I'm talking, you will begin to notice some pauses between my words. In those spaces, what was going on in your mind? There it was again. You were silent. You were aware without a thought going on in your head. That's why it's a very skillful and effective trick. You know, for the first time, many people have realized, oh, I can be silent. There it is again. And it's beautiful. It's profound. It's deep. And somehow or other, you know there's so much freedom and meaning to be found in that silence. So by giving you a taste of that silence, now you understand its value. Now you have to increase its length of time, so you're more and more and more silent. Lovely, isn't it? So once you start to value the silence and take the value off the thinking, you find that there will be many, many more moments of silence throughout your day. Silence will grow on you, literally, until, you know, you only think when you really have to, and when you don't, you won't. The related technique which helps you remain silent is actually doing what we call little mantras. A mantra is a group of words you say to yourself over and over and over. It's, you know, what the Buddha said in the Sabhasava Sutta of like substitution, substituting one thing for another. So the thinking goes on and on and on. So you want to substitute a thought, yes, this is a thought, a mantra which you say to yourself, but a very simple thought. Instead of having the thoughts go all over the place, take the one set of words, a mantra, a thought, and keep repeating it again and again and again, because it blocks out the other thoughts. Now, many of the mantras which I heard, you know, as a young monk, yeah, they didn't really work. And one of the reasons why they didn't work is because the way it was used. It's not just repeating the mantra over and over and over and over again. It's important, if you're using mantras to make the mind silent, is to put spaces between the words. Now, there are many, many different mantras, and I just mentioned, you know, the one I was talking about the last time I was overseas, was the old Tibetan mantra, the Om Mani Padme Hum mantra, which is, you know, I thought was the most famous. You know, I knew that as a kid. So you could use that if you like. If you're a diehard Theravada, you can, you know, use sort of, you know, Namo Buddhaya, that's the Indonesian greeting, Namo Buddhaya. That means homage to the Buddha. Oh, I don't know, you can make up your own mantras if you like, but the important thing, if you're doing, it's just a Theravada, Namo Buddhaya, say. If you're doing that as a mantra, remember to put spaces between the syllables. Na, mo, bud, daya. If it's Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om. Because the spaces are more important than the words. If you're very restless and thinking a lot, lots of things worrying about, close up those spaces. Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. But as you settle down, increase the spaces. Om Mani Padme Hum. And the more you quieten down, the more you lengthen the spaces between those words. Om Mani Padme Hum. Until those spaces get so long, you don't need to say the words anymore. It's a way of learning how to be silent inside. How to stop this terrible thinking mind. And if you ever get upset, angry, anxious or whatever, then you'll always find that there's so many thoughts going on in your head. And it's great to find this circuit breaker, this switch, you can just switch to try and stop all these crazy thoughts, and that's one thing which you can do. Get your mantra. If you're getting really crazy, Om Mani Padme Hum, 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 Om Mani Padme Hum. It's like having going down the gears, you know, in a car whose brakes have failed. It works. So, that's how you can learn how to be quieter, by using that little technique. You can make up your own mantra. The most important part is putting spaces between the words and getting to know that silence, getting to respect it, getting to value it. And after you value it, it grows. Now there's also the problem, which I mentioned last night in brief, which is an important part of meditation, it's an important part of the spiritual path, fear. You know, it's amazing how many people are afraid of silence. When I first came over here to this part of the bush, we had this beautiful land opposite where our monastery now stands, it's very quiet. And sometimes we had visitors coming in, and as soon as they came in, they raised their voice. They spoke louder than necessary. And I've seen that many times in quiet parts of the world. People actually raise their voice, almost shouting. And I was really wondering, what is the psychological reason for that? They don't need to speak so loud. And after a little consideration, you realize that the silence was so threatening to them, they needed to destroy it with loud talking, more than is necessary. Because silence is a bit scary if you're not used to it. So, to understand how to overcome the different fears which happen in meditation, I say in every level of every stage of meditation, I describe there are three levels. And this is a wonderful little insight into, you know, understanding how to relax and be peaceful and let things be. Those three levels are recognition, familiarity, and ease. Now, to understand what I mean, you've just come to Jhana Grove, many of you for the first time at this retreat center. When you first came in, say yesterday, you know, you couldn't even recognize the place. You didn't know which cottage was which room is which. Hopefully last night you went to the right cottage and you went in the right room. instead of barging into someone else's, because they all look pretty much the same. But now you probably, even just 24 hours, you probably recognize your room. Some of you have been coming here for years, and it's like a second home to you. Now already, you know, you're getting to know where the toilets are, how things work, you know, where the food is. And that's usually one of the first things people figure out, where the food, where the tea and coffee is. But once you know how it all works, you've recognized the place and how it works, and next you get familiar with it. Look, by, you know, midway during this retreat, you know, you think about, that's my room, and you go back and it's nice and cozy, that's your bed, your body recognizes it, you start to sleep well, you can relax. You've got so familiar with the place, your room, your cottage, your friends, you know, your little place where you sit down to meditate, your place on the dining room where you sit, it's familiar to you. After familiarity, then we can relax, we can get ease. And that is when you don't even think, you know, about which way should I go, and what are the rules, and what should I be doing. Because you've got so familiar, so relaxed with the rules of the place, it's just second nature. You know, sometimes people ask, you know, me that, I'm sure the bhikkhunis in front would appreciate this. They said, isn't it hard keeping all these rules as a monk? I have 227 to keep. You have 311. Actually, we've got heaps more than that, but that's our main rules. That must get really hard keeping all those rules. No, it's not. I'm just so familiar with them now. You just relax. I'm at ease with them. That's why you never, you know, feel like I'm tense keeping all my rules as a monk. But when you first become a monk, you know, like Upasama on the end here, he's only been a novice, you know, for a few weeks. You know, it's very hard, very tense. You know, what rule am I breaking? I'm sure I'm breaking something. I'm not quite sure. But after a while, you get relaxed, and you get familiar, you get at ease. Those are the three stages. And that's the same with something like silence. First of all, you've got to recognize, what do we mean by silence? And many people have actually asked me, said, oh, what do you mean? You have to think. What are you guys on about? You know, keeping peaceful, keeping quiet. What is this meditation anyway? So that exercise which I gave you, you can actually recognize, ah, that's what they mean by silence. You've experienced it. The space between the words. And once you recognize it, then you become familiar with it. And it's in that familiarity that the fear disappears. Oh, it's only silence again. I remember this, an old Zen story I haven't told for years and years and years. I was just reminded of it when I just looked at the corner over there. That there was a Zen monastery. This was the great Zen teacher, Lin Chi. You know, we usually know him as Rinzai. And these were those, you know, Japanese monasteries, you may have seen them in the movies, where the master, the teacher, comes around with a big stick. And he walks very mindfully, and if anybody just nods even slightly, whack, right on their back. You know, I went to a monastery like that once. This was when I was young. I would go to it. This was, they had this, the Throstle Hole Monastery in England. And they had this, oh, it was an old barn converted, you know, to being their zendo. And you're meditating there in the morning. You had to get up really early in the morning. And it was so cold, you had to put a blanket on. The problem with blankets, you know, psychologically, blanket means bed, bed means sleep. So you put a blanket close to you, and straight away you start nodding. So I was nodding, and that was a very dangerous thing to do. But you know, throughout my whole life, I've always had good karma. You know, I've always been very lucky. And my luck that particular day was, the guy sitting next to me was more sleepy than I was. So he was the guy who got hit. Whack! And you know, you don't have to be hit to overcome sleepiness. Just the guy getting next to you gets hit, overcame all my sleepiness. I wasn't sleepy at all. I was vertically straight. Because it really sounded terrible. But you don't need to do that for fear. After a while, you know, you just, you know, you got used to everything. You didn't get afraid anymore. But this Lin Chi, early in the morning in the Zendo, he was half asleep, and the master came in with a big stick. And yeah, monks are very compassionate. So the monk sitting next to him sort of elbowed him. The master's here. And Lin Chi was down here somewhere. And he just looked with one eye. Just not two eyes. He was that lazy. One eye would do. And he saw the big master come in. He said, only that geezer. Only that guy. And he carried on sleeping. And at that, the master exploded. The master sort of scolded everybody. Oh, you monks in this monastery, none of you know anything about Buddhism and about Dharma. Only Lin Chi, he's the only one who understands. Carry on sleeping. I love that story. The reason was because all the other monks were afraid, control freaks. Now Lin Chi was only going, relaxed. Understand what I mean? That's why we don't have any sticks over here, because otherwise you'd get even more afraid and uptight. But the point of the thing is that fear is what stops us enjoying the silence. We're not really quite sure what we're supposed to be doing. Is this right? Can I really be enjoying myself? Can I be peaceful? Is that right? Do I deserve this? After a while, you do get familiar with these things. And just like familiarity, it takes away all fear. And then you can really relax. And you can enjoy the silence as much as you like. Same in this retreat here. After a while, you know, you realize, you know, Ajahn Brahm hasn't got a big stick. You're not going to get expelled. You're not going to be given a hard time. You know, you don't have anything to be afraid of. Then you can really, really, really relax. So those are the three stages. And that happens with every part of meditation, whether it's, you know, learning how to sit, you know, comfortably with your body. First of all, we're afraid. You know, what am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to sit? Is this right? Is this wrong? I'm going to get into trouble. And after a while, you get familiar with the position which suits you. And after a while, then you can really relax. So remember those three stages, or three levels: recognition, familiarity, and ease, comfort, letting go. So that also happens with silence. The other part of silence, which is important, it's almost like a precursor of silence, and it really helps you stay peaceful, is present moment awareness. In other words, no past, no future, just now. That's all the time you have. All the time you've ever had. It's just this moment. Every time I wake up in the morning, it always feels the same day. It's like Groundhog Day. That's actually much more true than most people think. Yeah, I still feel the same. My body gets a bit older, the clock changes, the season changes, but I always feel pretty much the same. What's really changing? The present moment is always the same. It's just now, just now, just now, just now. Body gets old. People come and people go. But this moment is just the same as it was just when you first came in here, pretty much. It feels that way. So see if you can come into that present moment. It's a place where life is happening. Not like these reruns on television. Not like old jokes which you've heard many times before. Not sort of fantasies about the future and dreams about what's going to happen next. But actually being in life as it happens. They always say that history is written by the winners. It's also written by the losers as well. Which one are you? Don't be either a winner or a loser. All that history, all those things which ever happened to you, please let them go. Don't bring them in this meditation room. You have to leave your shoes outside. One day I'm going to put two baskets outside, past and future. And leave them in that basket when you come into meditation. You can pick them out afterwards, like your shoes, and put them on afterwards. Your left shoe and your right shoe, the past and the future. But please don't bring them into meditation with you. Because if you do, you're just burdening yourself again and again and again. The past is finished, and it is written by the winners or the losers. Now, if you think you're a loser, you write it in sort of really dull grey ink. And if you're a winner, you write it in multi-coloured ink. Neither of them are accurate. That's why we let go of the past. So for anyone here who's coming into this retreat with lots of bad experiences from the past, bad memories, people have been cruel to you, they've hurt you, they've cheated you, they've dumped you in a relationship, they've given you such a hard time, your life has been a total mess up to this point. In order to deal with that, deal with it today. What you have to do is first of all acknowledge it. Any psychologist knows that going into denial doesn't help anybody. Acknowledge it. Write it down on a piece of paper. That's one of the best ways of acknowledging it. In detail, clearly, neatly. And the best piece of paper to use for the purpose is what's called toilet paper. It's the best thing to use for anything which is shitty. And that's what you're writing down, isn't it? All the shit of your life. So you write it down in detail. Once you've finished writing it down in detail, you've got to read it. You know, to actually face up to it. Okay, yeah, this happened to me, that's really awful. But once you've written it down, once you've read it, what's the next thing you have to do? Take it to the place where toilet paper belongs. The loo, the toilet bowl. Put it in there and press the button and let it go. And as it disappears down that bend into the sewage system way down there, with it goes all your bad memories of the past. That's where the shit belongs. It gets recycled later on, but you know, in a form you never really know. And that way, you can let go of all the pain and the shit of your past. Do that. But if you do it, just know, only a couple of sheets at a time, please. Because otherwise, all our toilets are going to be blocked in this place. With all the shit which you're carrying around. But you know, that actually works, because that's actually how to let go of the pain of the past. You know, it's okay, someone like me can go, I'll just let it go, come on, just it's the past, forget about it. Yeah, but you can't do that. So you need something physical to do. That's writing it down, acknowledging it, bringing it up, reading it, so acknowledging it. And the last thing, you need some sort of ceremony to let it go, to allow it to disappear. Just like you know that sometimes when people die, they have these balloons. And you know, you let the balloon go and it soars up to heaven because that's where you want your loved one to go to. And even though you know that it's just, you know, the atmosphere up there, nothing else, there's no heavenly beings up there, but you know, our culture, heaven is up there somewhere. So you let the balloon go and it flies up there. And the psychological message is given to your brain is, oh, they're going to heaven, I'm letting go, I'm letting them go. It's a wonderful way of overcoming grief. Similarly, I've been to the crematoriums in Singapore. You know, there are some crematoriums in the West. I don't know if they have this in the United States. But you put the casket on this platform, and at the end of the ceremony, they commit the coffin. Now, I'm the sort of the guy who does the service. I press this button, and that coffin goes down. That's really, really stupid. Because psychologically, what's that telling you? Going down, oh my goodness, they're going down to hell. That is not a good message to give to people who've already got enough psychological problems with dealing with grief. So, you know, years and years ago, now it's actually Fremantle, those of you who live here, the Fremantle Cemetery, they were doing an upgrade of their crematorium. And I suggested to them, look, why don't, instead of having it go down, why don't you have it just rise up into the air? No, literally, that'd be brilliant. Now, some hydraulic lift, so the coffin there, once, you know, there's beautiful chanting and it goes up into the air and then just goes through a trapdoor in the ceiling with all this dry ice, this clouds and heavenly music. And then when the ice disappears, they're gone. Now, what a wonderful crematorium that would be. I'm wasted being a monk. I could make $1 billion in business being in a picture like that. Now, why not? It'll give this beautiful message. And I think one of the objections was, he said, look, if we did that, some of our clients, would complain. Complain about what? They'd say, I know my father. No way would he go up there. So you know what I suggested? I wrote this in my book. I suggested, okay, we can have three options. That three buttons, one button to go down, one button to go up, and one button to go horizontal, for those ones, not quite sure. And I suggested, to make it really, really interesting, at the funeral service, all of your friends and relations, people who have known you, they could have buttons by their seats. So I think it'd be like a vote, like democracy. So if the more buttons were going up, then they went up, more buttons going down, unfortunately they go down. And if more buttons going up, wouldn't that make funerals more interesting to go to? You could even have some bets, have some bookmakers outside. Why not? But anyway, look, you can see just the psychology of going up is like heaven, going down is going to hell. Putting things in the toilet, flushing it, is getting rid of stuff which you shouldn't really be keeping. So actually, it's powerful psychology. I told that at a recent psychology conference in Sydney. They really got off on that. They were going to actually do it. And I was serious. It's funny. Yeah, I admit it's funny. Sometimes I do say funny things. Not always, but sometimes. But this actually works. So try that. I mean that. Try it. Somebody who's really bothering you, write on a piece of paper, look at it, put it in the toilet, flush it away. You'll find it does actually help you let go. So that's letting go of the past, especially the rotten things which happened in the past. The good things which happened in the past, you can keep those if you like. Years ago, I gave the simile of your photo album. And that people don't usually keep photo albums these days. They've got it all on their USBs or their hard drives. But the times you used to have these photo albums? You used to keep all these photo albums. I've seen many photo albums. And what do you see in the photo albums? You see that photos of, when you're on holiday, photographs of your wedding, photographs of, your kids, going on holiday somewhere. Photographs of when you graduated from school or university. Those are the photographs I've seen. I've never seen ever a photograph of someone's divorce. They don't tend to put that in their album. I've never seen a photograph of them going to work on a Monday morning in the traffic. Holidays, not going to work. Seeing photographs of graduation ceremonies. I've never seen a photograph of a person doing their assignments at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning in front of the computer. We only take photographs of the happy moments. And that's why we want to keep them, because, we can open up and it brings back these beautiful memories. That's psychologically positive. That's why we should have photo albums. But we have another photo album between our ears called our memory. And unfortunately, a long time ago, we deleted all the positive memories. And we filled it with these nasty photographs of that bastard who hurt us, that partner who let us down, they cheated and slept with our friend, that person who just, was so bullying we had to leave our job, that terrible person who did this, who did that. Why do we keep those photographs between our ears? Those are the photographs which you should delete or put on the toilet paper and flush away. They don't help you at all. Reason why. Somebody hurt you. They cheated you. But they didn't cheat you once. They cheated you 1,000 times. Every time you remember what they did, they are cheating you again. Cheating you out of your happiness and peace. They only cheated you once, but every time you remember it and recall it, you are allowing them to cheat you again. Someone called you a pig. Why do they call me a pig? I'm not a pig. They shouldn't call me a pig. and they've just called you a pig 3 more times. Every time you remember it, they call you a pig again. Every time you remember what they did, they're hurting you again. Why do you do that? At most, allow people to hurt you only once. Then let it go. Then you can only be hurt once, not thousands of times, when we remember these things. So, write it on a piece of paper, flush it away, and it's gone. And instead, keep the happy memories. And as for the future, who knows what's going to happen next? I don't know what. I never knew I was going to talk like this today. I was going to talk about something else when I came in here, but decided, I don't know, it didn't quite work out. Just so was my life. I never thought I'd become a monk. I had other plans, but, you know, it just sort of happened. Certainly not being a teacher. That was the last thing which I... Now, I had it all figured out. For those of you who know the history of this place, there was this other monk, Ajahn Chakro, was the senior monk here. And it was really good because he was senior monk. I was like tailgating, you know, just going behind the big truck, because the truck in front always gets the bugs on the windscreen. And unfortunately, his truck decided to veer off the road. He got married, and I was stuck. So I had to... Now I get all the bugs on the windscreen, being the senior one. I don't know how I let this happen to me. But anyway, here we are. So, look, life never works out the way you expect. So, basically, you don't know what's going to happen next. You don't know what's going to happen next. It doesn't really bear thinking about it. If you were to prove this to yourself, go and write yourself a time capsule. Just write on a piece of paper again what you think is going to happen in the next 12 months and where you think you're going to be in 12 months' time. In 12 months' time, open it up. And you'll be so surprised. You shouldn't be surprised, but it will confirm to you that what actually happened was not what you expected. It was totally beyond your expectations. Things which you couldn't really imagine have now happened to you. It's just proving to you just how unpredictable, uncertain the future is. So unpredictable and uncertain, it's a waste of time thinking about it. Because you don't know what's going to happen. You can't know what's going to happen. It's unpredictable. So because of that, after a while, I said, geez, why am I even thinking about the future? It's a total waste of time. So instead, be in the present moment. And the compelling argument is, if you really are concerned about your future, where is your future being made? When is the only time you can do anything about your future? Right now. So your future is being made right in this moment. If you care about your future, if you want to have a peaceful, happy, successful future, put the effort into the now. The place where your future is being made. If you make this moment peaceful, kind, gentle, loving, that's the most you can do for your future. That's what the law of karma means. Your future is made right now. You're making your karma in this moment. You're making peace for your future only by being peaceful now. Healthy future by being stress-free in this moment. If you want to have a compassionate, kind world around you, make this moment kind and compassionate. Then you are making your future by being in the present moment. And you know the great thing about the present moment, you can't think too much about the present moment. The future, you can imagine anything. Those science fiction, predictions, end of the world, so many things you can think about the future. And the past as well, keep going on and on about what you should have done and what you could have done and what you... Oh, that just goes on and on and on. But in the present moment, you're right here. Nothing much to think about. It's peaceful. It's beautiful. But most important of all, it's true. The future is a lie waiting to happen. The past, a lie. memories, what you thought happened, which have all been distorted. The past is a lie, the future is a lie. Only the now is true. Makes sense, doesn't it? So if you want to find truth, if you want to be true, be now. Be peaceful. Be silent. And already you have heaps and heaps of good meditation happening. So, already I've gone over time again. That's just what happens. But that gives you something to work on today. Be in the moment, learn to be silent, but also remember, be kind. Give yourself a break. Don't work too hard. If you like sitting, sit. If you like walking, walk. If you like lying down, lie down. Have a cup of tea, have a cup of tea. If you like yawning, yawn. If you want to go to sleep right where you are, fall asleep right where you are. Be kind to yourself. Give yourself a break. But most important, if you feel like speaking, shut up.